Hey boys and girls, you are listening to Truth to You. That's truth number 2, letteru.org. And it is time for Light of the Prophets with Yoel Ben Shlomo. G'day, mate.
G'day to you too.
We are halfway through chapter 18 of 1 Samuel. How about that?
Yeah, it's we're getting there. We're getting along. And the feedback on David and Goliath was amazing.
Mm.
Also, people were very appreciative of the program with about the kippah and tzitzit.
Yes.
And I also discovered that our programs are also shared on other websites. I did something kind of funny. I Googled myself.
Yeah.
And I, you know, that's very self-centered. But I was wondering, you know, I wanted to see where it goes to.
Yeah.
And apparently our programs, including old ones that we did years ago, mm-hmm. Are shared on other websites.
That's great.
And it's pretty cool.
I'd love to hear that, because it is just a reminder to the listeners, it is free to download. They are downloadable. Feel free to share them and to email them and to share them on Facebook. That reminds me. I usually tell everyone, Yoel, about Hebrew in Israel. That's your Facebook page, Hebrew in Israel. Tell people to go there and like that and engage with the information there. I'm just a bit concerned, everybody who's listening, because Yoel almost has more friends than me on Facebook, and we can't have that.
Oh, rubbish.
He's got almost more likes than me on Facebook. So now I'm going to say to everyone...
No, that's not true.
No. It's a popularity contest, and I want everybody to go to Truth to You on Facebook and like my page. And after that,
okay, so,
after that
so,
then you can like Yoel's.
Yeah, right about that. Yeah, so... by the way, there actually is a small issue I do want to bring up. Mm-hmm. Some people have been offering to donate money.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very appreciative of this. And we will figure out a way of doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And this is basically how it goes. There's a legal matter here, because I am set up as a business. I'm not supposed to receive donations. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And, but I did, and here's the thing. I do have an accountant. So I asked him about this. And he said that I'm legally allowed to receive money as a gift if someone sends it to me outside of my work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, very, very simple. If someone is interested in sending anything, please contact me first. Okay?
Because I've had which email address?
You send me an email on Hebrew in Israel.
Hebrew in Israel at gmail.com.
At gmail.com.
Okay.
And you say, we're interested in helping you out. Now, you have to remember something. This doesn't go to pay my bills. I have my job. I don't go around asking for money. But people are very, very appreciative of what I do. So first of all, this money goes to buying books and time for research, and currently trying to buy a new laptop because this one's dying on me. And but we'll see what happens with that. This thing is surviving, so we're doing okay. And so basically it goes like this. It can be either one of two things. If you're interested in just donating a small sum of money, it's not a problem. If someone's interested in donating money on a regular basis, one of the things that can be done is you can send this as a payment of sorts, and then I can also produce a receipt for you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Which makes everything, I do everything above board, by the way. I don't muck around or play anything. I pay my taxes and everything. So if anyone's interested, and there have been some inquiries throughout the past couple of months, yes, you can. There are ways of legally doing this, but I've had people send me money on my PayPal account. They just typed in my email and sent something, you know, and I'm very, very appreciative. And I got flagged several times by PayPal, and they threatened to shut down my account. So do me a favor, if you're interested in donating money, first of all, contact me.
To email you first, because the rules, just to let everybody know, the rules are different from country to country when it comes to PayPal, as far as I understand. And particularly in Israel, there are some complications. And let me really encourage the listeners who really want to contribute back to Yoel after everything he's contributed to the program, not just Light of the Prophets, but all the other programs that we've done as well that are in the archives. I strongly encourage listeners to do that, and thank you to the listeners that do. The best way to do it is to contact Yoel first via his email, and that is HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com, HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com. com. That is the email to contact him on before you send any donations. Soon, we're hoping to see a website. So, the first thing for you at the moment is to move house. You're heading up north, as we mentioned last week.
Wow, what a mess!
And there's not much else you can think about besides that at the moment. But once that's all done, then we can start thinking about a website again and get that happening. Yeah. But in the meantime, please let me encourage not only to give back to Yoel for all that he's given us in his time and knowledge, but also taking into consideration that he is a Levite. He is a Levite in the land, and that should be taken into consideration as well. So, appreciate it for those of the listeners who would like to give back and contribute and donate to Yoel. Please do so and email him first at Hebrew in Israel at gmail.com.
That's interesting. Gmail at Israel. We should create a thing like that. Gmail in Israel.
We should.
But by the way, you know something that I kind of noticed that I one day realized that Hebrew in Israel has a double meaning. It could mean the Hebrew language coming from Israel, and it can also mean a Hebrew in Israel. And it dawned on me one day because someone referred to me as Hebrew. Look at this. And I'm like,
oh, yeah.
No, Hebrew didn't mean a Hebrew in Israel. It was Hebrew in Israel, meaning the Hebrew language coming from Israel. But in any case, it had there a double meaning. The penny dropped on that one.
It's a great name, and it's an easy one to remember. HebrewInIsrael@gmail.com and Hebrew in Israel on Facebook after you've liked Truth to You on Facebook.
Like Truth to You. Don't forget to donate to Truth to You. Jono does all the work by himself, you know. And
at it now. You've got 1,518 likes.
Yeah, and I lost a whole bunch because of certain things I posted. You know, so you can't make everyone happy. You know, it's sometimes you post something and someone disagrees with you and they say, oh, I don't like this guy anymore. Learn to live with the idea that some people have other opinions. Mm. Okay? You have to learn to live with it. I deal with people all the time that have different opinions, literally all the time. There's some discussions which are not public on Facebook. And believe me, we get along. Some people know this. There was a dispute between I and another guy about the issue of starting a fire, and a fire on Yom Tov on a feast day. And it doesn't mean we're not going to continue corresponding. He has his opinion. I have my opinion. I think I'm right. He thinks he's right. One day we'll discover the truth together. But, you know, that's basically how it goes. I know I am right on this one. But anyhow.
All right. So here we are in 1 Samuel chapter 18. But, Yoel, I'm going to start with a verse. Just to go back and refresh our memories, I'm starting with a verse in 1 Samuel chapter 17. This is verse 25. And it says, so the men of Israel said, now it's speaking to David. Well, actually, let me go from a bit earlier. It says, so David heard, and all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, this is Goliath, they fled from him and they were dreadfully afraid. So the men of Israel said to David, have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he's come up to defy Israel. And it shall be that the man who kills him, well, the king will enrich with great riches, and he'll give his daughter and give his father's house exemption in Israel. So that's that's kind of where we're up to now. And now emphasizing, of course, that one of the benefits of killing Goliath is being married to the king's daughter, which is a pretty important status, really, is it not? Having the king as a father-in-law.
Yeah, having the king as a father-in-law, it can come in handy.
It can come
in handy sometimes.
That is, of course, if the king isn't a nutcase, but, isn't
in our case, the king's not a nutcase. He's just a sad story, you know. Saul wasn't a bad person.
He wasn't. No, he wasn't a bad person. But now he's being tormented by an evil spirit from God, which is sending him a little bit batty, right? Yeah. Okay.
A little bit batty. He's completely off his rocker at the moment.
We're going to be talking about that in a minute. But this is what happens in 1 Samuel chapter 18, verse 17. Then Saul said to David, here is my older daughter. Now, is this Merav?
Merav, yeah.
Merav.
Merav. Merav can be a game on, for example, Meir Rav. If you add a yud, there will be great water, or Merav means something to do with being great, or multitude, or being a lot of something. And this is his older daughter. So it was quite customary sometimes to give names which were symbolic. You know, name giving, calling names was very, very important in the ancient world. Mm-hmm. And even today, people still attribute things to names. Like, for example, someone's turned around to me. You know, I used to give a rough time to a certain friend of mine, and someone, it was a rough time. I was very blunt with him, and you know, tell him to his face the truth about certain things. So he mentioned this, and he mentioned this in front of a group of people. They know I used to be mean to him, and now we're very good friends. And you know, someone turned to me and says, "Does Yoel mean something about fear, so being angry or something?" I said, "No, just Yoel means Yah is El. He's the God."
Mm.
You know, and but name calling was very, very important. The ability to speak was very, very important. I mean, it was so important that, you know, in some cultures, in the Sumerian, for example, Sumerian culture, there's this story of Adapa, who was the first man who could speak, the ancient wise man.
Mm-hmm.
And the big thing about it was the fact that he could speak. He can use, you know, incantations to stop things. So speaking was very important. And when he named something, it gave a meaning. You know, so for example, when my third son was born, we called him Matityahu, mm-hmm. because for some reason my wife couldn't get pregnant again. It was really weird. I mean, we got married. She got pregnant very, very quickly. She gave birth. She became pregnant again very, very quickly. She gave birth to our second son, and then suddenly nothing, zilch.
Mm.
And we're sitting there for several years, and we're like, we want another kid. What's going on? And we started praying about it and wondering, and maybe we're doing something wrong. You know, we have two kids. We're very happy, but I want more than two kids. I want, you know. So my wife became pregnant again. We discovered there was some medical issue. It just by chance, we discovered there was a medical issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so chance means that God made sure we noticed it. And my third son was born, so it was very symbolic to us. So I called him Matityahu, which is basically Matat from Yahu, which is basically you know, a gift from Yah.
Mm.
And we called him Yosef. Yosef, because Rachel says, Yosef li Elohim ben Acher. You know, may God add another son to me.
Mm.
And so we use it as a symbol, and we say, you know, he's a gift, and we want another one. And in a very, very short period of time, Halevi the Fourth was born. Prince Halevi the Fourth was born, and we called him Yehonatan. We looked at him as another gift, and
great
he's
name.
So cute. He's a tiny little thing, so he's like, yeah, we can gift wrap him if you want. You know, really sweet. And by the way, to his credit, I know I'm schmoozing a lot today, but this was very exciting. I was hanging the laundry, and how many husbands can say, I do the cooking, washing, laundry, and take care of the children? I don't think too many husbands can say that. And I also changed diapers. I was hanging the laundry, and suddenly I realized he's picking things out of the laundry basket, and he's handing them to me.
Ah, that's brilliant.
And he's helping me out, and then we were done with that. He immediately pulls out the thing with the pegs, and he starts giving me pegs.
Ah, that's great.
You know, he's very intelligent. He's there's something special about him.
He is. He's,
in any case,
His Highness Prince Halevi the Fourth. It's very great to have him on the program.
His Highness or His Hiney, child, diapers. Well, in any case, so after we schmoozed, names were very, very important back then. Names were symbolic. So this is the older daughter. So by the way, he's following the practice. You first of all offer the older daughter. And by the way, this practice is kept until this very day in ultra-Orthodox communities. You do not marry if your older brother and sister is not married yet.
Wow.
And this is what the custom comes here. And this is why it took Michal, the younger daughter, to intervene to actually enable him to marry, for David to marry Michal.
Mm-hmm.
Because he first of all, if he marries anyone, he first of all has to marry the older daughter.
So it's
because Michal loved David, so Saul said, okay, so whatever, we'll find a husband for Mirav.
Yeah, but it didn't quite work out like that. I mean, it says, Shaul says, I will give her to you for a wife. Only be valiant for me and fight Yehovah's battle. For Saul thought, let my hand not be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him. So what's happened, Yoel, correct me if I'm wrong, but he seems to have tacked on an additional condition from killing Goliath, but also, I will give my daughter to you as a wife. But not only have you killed Goliath, but I also want to have your word that you will fight Yehovah's battles And
well, it's conditions. It's conditions of marriage. You have to understand that, you know, today people do a prenup, which has nothing to do with what they used to do back then. Mm-hmm. But they always had conditions. You want to get married, my daughter, here are the conditions. So that was perfectly normal. You know, you want a wife, you go up to the father, and they settle on conditions. How much do you pay him? You know, what rights would be. In the city of Nuzi, which I'm going to mention later on again, mm-hmm. in the city of Nuzi, they had you know, things very similar to the idea of the ketubah. You know, it wasn't rabbis who invented the idea of the ketubah. It's something with a marriage certificate, mm-hmm. a marriage agreement was a well-established thing way, way, way back then, and might have been practiced in Israel as well. Or that you said you made an oral agreement, and even today an oral agreement is considered to be a contract. It's called an oral contract. Mm. And, they would make an oral contract and they would do it in front of, you know, they'll say it in front of a group of people, or they'll have two witnesses that say, yes, we witnessed this, the details of this contract. And so here he's saying, you want to marry my daughter? Here's what I want. I want you to fight the wars of God.
Mm.
So he's making a deal with him. But he doesn't want money. He doesn't want anything.
It's interesting. One of the things that it reminds me of, though, Yoel, is it's not just that he will fight Yehovah's battle, because in the back of his mind he's thinking, because, you know, I might not kill him, but hopefully he's thinking the Philistines will kill him. And it kind of reminds me. It actually reminds me of David, and Uriah
later on.
Uriah, yeah. We'll get there on. Eventually in 2 Samuel 11:15, he gives direction to, Joab, I think, direction to...
He gives directions to Joab, and Joab and tells him, you know, put him in front of where the fighting is most fierce and make sure he gets killed.
Mm, make sure he gets killed. And that's... But I think they were fighting the Ammonites, but... No.
Yeah, they were fighting Ramat ben Ammon. They were fighting the capital city of Ammon.
Yeah, so it's interesting. We will get to that, but it goes on to say in 18, so David said to Shaul, who am I... Now, I'm curious about this, Yoel. How do you understand this? Because he says, who am I and what is my life or my father's family in Israel that I should be the son-in-law to the king? But he's already qualified on a number of times prior to killing Goliath in chapter 17. He knows that if he kills Goliath, this is part of the reward. So why is he now saying, who am I that I should?
So there are two ways of reading this, I would say. One is he's being generous. He didn't go out... Remember something, he didn't go to fight Goliath because he wanted the money or the wife or anything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, but we do remember that he did go around asking this question over and over again.
Mm.
So he was interested to know what the king is going to do.
Mm-hmm.
But we also have to remember, very importantly, that his main point was to bring down Goliath. His main point was to fight the battle of God. Now, also, you have to remember this type of behavior of I'm not worthy, is also a polite way. You don't say yes immediately. You know, there's, for example, this rule in the Talmud that speaks about when you're in a synagogue and you've been offered to come and be the cantor, the man who leads the uh-huh. prayer service. You know, it's called a chazan. Today, modern Hebrew, it's called a chazan. In Mishnaic Hebrew, chazan means something else. And you don't immediately say yes. You in the beginning you say no, and mm-hmm. then you kind of like, you might be, you know, maybe you're willing to do it, and then the third time you say yes. So you don't immediately jump, oh yeah. There's a certain polite way of accepting something.
Uh-huh.
You know, when you walk into someone's house, even today here in Israel, you walk into someone's house and they offer you something to drink. Some places they still remember this rule, and they're offered something to drink and something to eat, and you say no, and then they say you're sure, and you say maybe something small, and in the end they bring out food and put it on the table. I've been through that many, many times. The thing is, my family originally comes from Europe, so European Jews don't really know what that means, but North African Eastern Jews, they know exactly what it means.
Sure.
So when you go into a family who's lives in Israel, it's from the East or from North Africa, you probably expect that you'll say no, and they'll anyhow do it in the end. There are several times until they put it out.
So you're not objecting. Obviously, David isn't objecting to being the son-in-law of the king. Rather, he's approaching the situation with politeness, with courtesy, with humility.
Yeah, it's a way how you do it. You have to remember, these were traditional societies. You know, today, tradition, no one even thinks about traditions. There's nothing. There's no rules anymore. There's no patterns of behavior. Mm. Everyone does whatever they want. Be yourself.
Mm.
You know, live free, do whatever you want. And back then, you know, you were allowed to be yourself, but there were also certain types of courtesies that existed.
Social etiquette
that you had to abide to.
Okay, fair enough.
You know, you had to abide by. You know, and this is the thing. You know, for example, you know, when you get married, there's certain things you have to go through and sort of agreements that you make with the parents, you know, and there was a lot of things that now they're all died out because people don't live in traditional societies. And I actually heard that there's a study now they discovered in the United States, for example, that a lot of women, a lot of, okay, let's be very, very blunt here, a lot of Caucasian women are marrying into families which are more traditional families, you know, from, you know, Spanish background, mm-hmm. Oriental background, people that come from, you know, more traditional families because they want to feel more secure. They have this environment around them that protects them.
Right.
You know, a feeling of family, a feeling of value.
Very
you
interesting.
Know, so it's a very interesting thing. People want to go back to tradition, mm-hmm. want to go back to having some kind of logic in the world that they don't do whatever you want.
So choosing more traditional cultures for the sake of security that culture offers.
Exactly.
Okay. But nevertheless, yeah, well, it goes on in 19 and it says that it happened that at the time when Merav, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, that she was given to Adriel. Adriel?
Adriela Mecholati. No, it wasn't that she was, no, when the word tet here is not really to be given, it was offered.
Is it possible?
It means that something's a bit fishy here. And maybe David also knew of this. This is why he also declined, because he knew that she was already offered to someone else.
Maybe, I mean, it goes on to, it talks about, now we're introduced to Michal, and it talks about how she loved David. We're not told, but is it possible that Merav loved Adriel? And so Shaul gave her permission to be married. Maybe it was her preference.
No, first of all, the fact that it's mentioned that she loved David, that's a very, very unusual thing. It's one of the very, very few cases in the Bible where it mentions that someone, a woman loved a man. It's extremely rare.
That's interesting.
It's almost non-existent.
Now that you say that, because it reminds me of Isaac, when Rebecca arrived, it says, and he loved her. But tell me another example of where a woman says, and she loved him.
Well, first of all, you have the Song of Songs, which is in general a love song.
So very good.
Obviously, that will happen, but there aren't too many cases.
That's interesting. Why is that?
There are very, very few cases where it mentions that someone loved someone, but specifically a woman loving a man. This is why it's mentioned. You have to remember that back then in those societies, love, who cares about love? You learn to love your wife, and the woman learns to love her husband mm-hmm. somewhere along the line. For example, I put this, my experience. I come from a religious background where we don't really have girlfriends. You know, I didn't go out with my wife for years or so, for a year or so before we decided to get married. Mm. We were offered to meet one another through a mutual friend who happens to be my brother-in-law today. Mm-hmm. And we met and we sat down, we spoke and we had the conversation and at one point we both realized that it's a good match mm-hmm. and we got married. Can I say that I loved my wife? No, it came in time. Mm. Same thing with my wife. You know, when we got married, you know, my mother asked me, "Do you love her?" Now, my parents come from a culture where a girlfriend was acceptable. Mm-hmm. I, on the other hand, grew up here in Israel in a place where girlfriends were not acceptable. Mm-hmm. So my mother turns around and says to me, "Do you love her?" And I said, "I will learn to love her in time." Mm. But we kind of realized that we have the same ideals and we have the same direction. You know, so this is why pointing out that Michal loved David was a very, very important thing. By the way, notice another thing. Jonathan loves David as well. Mm-hmm. There's an interesting pattern here. The two children of Saul love David. Mm-hmm. And that must have really annoyed Saul.
I bet it did, actually. Yeah, that's a good point. Well, actually, you know what? Yeah, we do know for a fact in the next chapter, and we may get there today, it does annoy Saul. We see an example of that.
Yeah, and so it's remarked that she loved him because this is before they got married, and all that, and this is why also as a tactic, Saul made a mistake because if you marry off the daughter who loves him, you don't have an ally that can work against David. David has an ally, and this is part of the problem that Saul has. He's not thinking straight. He should have given Michal. He should have completely ignored the fact that she's supposed to marry Adriel and basically marry off Merav to David so he has someone who can work with him
uh-huh.
to conspire against David.
So, even so, Shaul seems to say, I will give her to him that she may be a snare to him and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. So at least he's thinking, in my mind as I read this, I think what Shaul is thinking is, well, at least he'll be my son-in-law and he'll be indebted to me to fight the Philistines, and that way I have a chance to end this guy.
Okay, so yeah, I mean, again, there's sometimes, okay, here's a possibility. Mm-hmm. It could be that what was going through Saul's head is that because she loves him, you know, the moment that you have, if you remember something, in their world, the man didn't really necessarily have to love the woman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the woman was something, you know, you married because you wanted children, still, you're married to her. And if you fall in love with another woman, you can marry another woman. You don't really care.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the type of society they were living in. Women were considered to be somewhat of an object, not an object in meaning that you buy and sell, but a certain degree, the father had rights over the wife, and then when she marries off, the husband has rights over the wife, and he doesn't necessarily have to love her. All he has to do is you know, make sure that she has what she needs.
Specifically, like in the Torah, Yoel, there are three things, right? There is the marital rights, his duty as the husband, clothing, mm-hmm. food, and shelter, right? That she is provided for. And so to that degree, they certainly care, but this is the situation.
Exactly. So it might be that now in this case that she actually loves him, that it's more compelling for him to do whatever she tells him to do,
mm-hmm.
which means he can sit down with his daughter and say, okay, tell him to do this and this because mm-hmm. you love him,
mm-hmm.
you know, and maybe that was a tactic that was going through his head. But uh-huh. we have to remember he has a bad spirit hovering around his head all the time. So maybe he's not thinking straight. He's doing the exact opposite of what logic would teach. He's seeing a certain situation and his mind's telling him, oh, that's a great opportunity, but it's the exact opposite. What it's actually doing is letting David get his foot into the door more and more.
Sure. And therefore, Shaul said to David a second time, you shall be my son-in-law today. And Shaul commanded his servants, communicate with David secretly and say, look, the king has delight in you. All his servants love you. So there you go. Not only Jonathan and Michal, but all his servants. Now, therefore, become the king's son-in-law. So Shaul's servants spoke these words in the hearing of David, and David said again.
By the way, notice something very important here as well. The servants of Shaul, they're actually lying through their teeth. They're actually lying. They're working with Shaul to conspire against David. Okay, they're speaking with him in secret, and Saul's telling them, tell him this. I've seen some commentators actually say that there's a very good possibility here that they're actually conspiring against David with Saul.
Fair enough. Okay, it's a possibility. And so, David says again, does it seem to you a light thing to be the king's son-in-law? See, I'm poor and lightly esteemed. I'm a lightly esteemed man, he says. And the servants of Shaul told him, saying, in this manner David spoke. They said to Shaul, and Shaul said, thus you shall say to David, the king does not desire any dowry, but 100 foreskins of the Philistines to take vengeance on the king's enemies. Yoel, a couple of things here. It would appear that back in the day, it was the man who brought the dowry, right?
Yeah, the dowry was given by the man. The dowry was actually given as insurance that if they ever get divorced, she has something to live off of until she gets remarried.
Mm-hmm.
There are some places where it mentions in the Torah, there's one place where it mentions 50 silver pieces
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
or 50 silver shekels, which is about enough money back then for a while, maybe even a couple of years.
That's a decent size of money.
Yeah, it's a decent size of money. But again, a dowry could have been other things. So for example, we talks about 50 silver shekels.
Mm.
It has to do with a man who raped a woman who wasn't engaged or anything.
So he's actually paid the bride price.
Yeah, so he pays. First of all, it can be a fine as well. So 50 silver shekels doesn't necessarily have to be the amount. But also paying in silver, where it's something that doesn't deteriorate that quickly, mm. means that it's also a fine. So when you fine someone, he's actually paying actual money.
Mm-hmm.
But it means that dowry could be anything. You know, you go in and you give the father. You know, I know a guy whose grandmother in Yemen was sold for five camels and 10 sacks of grain or something. You know, so it doesn't necessarily have to be silver or anything like that. But also, that's one thing. Now, also, why such a weird...
This is what Dowie. I want to know. I mean, does Shaul have some kind of strange fetish that we should know about? Or
no, he's trying to get him killed. He's telling him, go attack 100 Philistines. Mm-hmm. So he's not going to attack 100 Philistines head on. He's going to attack like 3 here, 5 there. But, you know, he's saying he's creating a large number of instances that he has to deal with Philistines to make sure that at least in one of them he'll get killed. Now, why does he say foreskins? Because if you'd say a finger or a nose or an ear, he can get that from anyone. He's saying foreskins because the Philistines were some of the only people in this area, or the only people in this area did not circumcise.
Right.
Circumcision wasn't special just for the Israelites. It was practiced amongst different groups, and the Philistines were the only ones that came from a different area. They came from Crete. They came from Greece, yep. where they didn't circumcise. Mm-hmm. It actually was considered to be an abomination in the Greek eyes yep. to circumcise someone because you're defiling the perfect creation of man. This is why in the Olympics, the original Olympics, they did it all in the nude to celebrate mm-hmm. the human body. Mm-hmm. So for them, this was a desecration of the human form, which is, by the way, something you hear today a lot, specifically mm-hmm. in California. There was about a year ago, there was this whole idea of foreskin man, this whole noise about circumcision, and mm-hmm. it's very interesting that they were only the evil people in this comic book called Foreskin Man were rabbis. They never spoke about Muslims. Muslims mm-hmm. also circumcised, and they never spoke about the Muslims. They only see images of rabbis, and they're the evil characters.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole noise
that,
about
yeah.
being yeah. There's a whole noise about being anti-Semitic, and they brought the whole thing down. But, you know, circumcision wasn't special just to the Hebrews. It was something that was practiced by Ammonites, Moabites, Egyptians. There are wall reliefs in Egypt where you see circumcision. They used to circumcise when they were 17, by the way.
Mm.
Their circumcision was done when they were 17.
Ouch.
Muslims up to about a couple decades ago used to circumcise at the age of 13. Mm-hmm. They circumcise like the next day the child's born. They'll do the circumcision.
Of course, in the Torah, it's on the eighth day. But what you're telling
Torah
me
is the eighth day, yeah.
what you're telling me, Yoel, is that it's not that Shaul wants a sack of foreskins. What he's really saying to David is, I want 100 Philistines, our enemy. I want 100 of those guys dead, and I want the receipt. And this is the receipt.
Exactly. The receipt is the foreskin.
Got it. Okay. And so this is what he asked for. But Shaul thought to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines. So when his servant told David these words, it pleased David well to become the king's son-in-law. Now, it's interesting, though. I keep thinking back. But he was promised Shaul's daughter, the king's daughter, after killing Goliath. No longer is that the case. He's got to kill 100 more Philistines as well. But
He's playing a game.
So now the days had not expired. Therefore, David arose and went, and he and his men killed 200 men.
There's a tactic in biblical language that when you use the word arose, vayakum, there's actually two adjacent verbs, vayakum David vayelich. So it's an issue of like, oh, okay, fine, great. And he runs off to do it. He's not even thinking twice. He just does it.
Okay. Just almost like when he killed Goliath. He ran to do the thing. And yeah. So he brings back 200 foreskins, there you go, Shaul, and gave them in full count to the king that he might become the king's son-in-law. Then Shaul gave Michal, his daughter, as a wife. Thus Shaul saw and knew that Yehovah was with David and that Michal, Shaul's daughter, loved him, and Shaul was still more afraid of David. So Shaul became David's enemy continually. Then the princes of the Philistines went out to war, and so it was whenever they went out that David behaved more wisely, and there's that phrase again, than all the servants of Shaul, so that his name became highly esteemed.
Mm-hmm. So actually, you know, it says that David succeeded more than the servants of Shaul, and his name was esteemed everywhere, or his name was greatly esteemed. So, yeah, I mean, suddenly, as I mentioned, it said maybe Saul thought one thing, and then suddenly he realized, wait, how dumb can I be? I just made the biggest mistake. I gave him another ally for my household.
Sure. And his approval rating, if you like, is skyrocketing for David.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So he's basically, David's already one foot in the door. He's getting in now.
He's getting in. There's no stopping it. And it's driving Shaul crazy, as we'll see in 19. We're going to continue into 19?
I think we should. And I think that we should make this a slightly longer program and make sure that we cover 19 as well.
Here we go.
By the way, there's a verse that says, Rabot machshavot belev ish, v'atza Adonai hitakum. You know, a man has many thoughts, but the will of the advice or the will of God, of the Lord, will be that which will stand. You know, you have one idea and it comes out the other way around. This is why, you know, you have an idea and it doesn't work out because God doesn't want it.
That's right. You
know, end of story.
Amen. Chapter 19 begins this way. Now Shaul spoke to Jonathan, his son, and to all his servants that they should kill David. But Jonathan, Shaul's son.
No. Translating that they should kill. No, he's saying that and said, no, we need to kill David. You know, lehamit doesn't necessarily mean we shall kill or anything like that. It's advice of killing. It's what's called an infinitive construct. It's not necessarily to do it now. It's the dealing with the prospect of getting rid of David, of killing him.
Ah, okay.
That I would translate as being maybe more that David spoke to Jonathan, his son, and his servants to kill David.
Okay.
Because lehamit means to kill. Literally, translation is to kill. That they're basically sitting there conspiring about the idea of killing David.
Right. But Jonathan, Shaul's son, delighted greatly in David. So Jonathan told David, saying, my father seeks to kill you. Therefore, please be on your guard until morning and stay in a secret place and hide. And I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I'll speak to my father about you. Then what I observe, I will tell you. So he's spying now for David.
Yeah, now he's spying, which is,
But it seems as though Jonathan is recognizing that his father is not balanced at this time. He's already had the experience when his father was going to kill him for eating a little bit of honey when he hadn't heard the ridiculous vow that Shaul made, saying no one is to eat anything until we've had victory over our enemies. I think that was maybe in chapter 14. So he can see how unbalanced and unhinged his father can become. And I think he's looking at David and perhaps he's thinking, this guy, as it says three or four times in chapter 18, this guy behaves wisely. This guy behaves wisely. I can trust in this guy. I can invest in this guy. I can, I want to be on this guy's side. And my father seems to be losing the plot. Is it possible?
Yeah, I think Jonathan is recognizing something that's going on. But it's very interesting. He's still very loyal to his father. He's loyal to his father to the bitter end.
Mm-hmm. And he goes, listen, you know, I think he goes about this the right way because he calls, he speaks to Shaul. Which verse am I up to? Oh, he goes, thus Jonathan spoke well of David to Shaul, his father, and said to him, let not the king sin against his servant, against David, because he has not sinned against you, and because his works have been very good towards you. For he took his life in his hands and killed the Philistine, that's Goliath, and Jehovah brought about a great deliverance for all Israel, and you saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood to kill David without cause? So Shaul,
his argument here is a double argument, by the way. What he's saying is, first of all, remember, it's actually a triple argument, but it's a double argument, essentially. First of all, he says to him, he put his soul in his hands. So nefesh, by the way, we mentioned this before, the nefesh actually means the throat in certain situations. Mm-hmm. So here it's a double meaning. It means his throat, and also it means his soul. So he's put himself in danger by putting his nefesh in his hand. Mm-hmm. And I've seen two explanations to this term. One means, you know, you put something in your hand and you open up your hand, it's there, it's exposed, it's endangered. Mm-hmm. But also it's an issue of putting a hand represents your deeds as well. Mm-hmm. So putting your own life and your own deeds, basically endangering yourself.
Yep.
So his argument is double. He says, first of all, he endangered himself against the Philistine to do your will to save Israel and mm-hmm. everything. And not only that, he's innocent blood.
Mm.
He's saying there's a double problem here. A, he's a hero of Israel, and B, he's innocent blood.
And therefore, he's reminding the Torah, right? He's reminding Shaul of the Torah.
Yeah, he's dam naki is a term used in different places that mentions mm-hmm. an innocent person. And when you do that, that is a great sin against God.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you see in several places, in the prophets and other places, you know, the dam naki shafach l'rov v'chutzot Yerushalayim says about Menashe, a lot of innocent blood he spilled in the streets of Jerusalem. This is a term, but it's something that makes God very, very, very angry.
So it's Deuteronomy chapter 19, verse 10, lest innocent blood shed lest innocent blood be shed in the midst of your land, which is Yehovah your God is giving you as an inheritance, and thus guilt of bloodshed be upon you.
Exactly. So he's basically saying, you really want the guilt of shedding innocent blood on your hands? Mm. He's referring back to Torah. He's referring to basically a legal and covenant term that basically means, you do that, you're putting yourself in great danger.
Mm. Yeah. And so Shaul heeded the voice of Jonathan, and Shaul swore. Now get this. Yeah, well, I mean, my goodness, he swore, as in the name of Yehovah, he said, as Yehovah lives, he shall not be killed. Then Jonathan called David, and Jonathan told him all these things, and Jonathan brought David to Shaul, and he was in his presence as in times past. Now, it doesn't last long.
By the way, he uses this very common oath variant, which is Chai Yud Hei Vav Hei, which is found in many, many places. It's a well-tested, well-known type of oath. Mm-hmm. And what's very interesting, if you actually look in a Hebrew Bible, it's the two words Chai, which means live or life or living, and then you have the name of God. They're connected with a thing called a makaf, which is a hyphen. Mm-hmm. And one of the rules about the hyphen is that these are two words which were separated, artificially separated from one another throughout time, and they were originally written as one word. And the thing about them is, if you look at, for example, letters of Lachish, just as an example, mm-hmm. You have Chai Yud Hei Vav Hei, and they're written as one word, and that the Yud of Chai and the Yud of the name is the same Yud, so there's only really one Yud there.
Really?
And it was an oath formula. It was written as one word and read out as one word.
Uh-huh. Interesting. So David is restored to his position, and there were wars again, and David went out and fought with the Philistines and struck them with a mighty blow, and they fled from him. Now, in verse 9, the evil spirit again. The evil spirit from Yehovah came upon Shaul as he sat in his house with his spear in his hand, and David was playing the music with his hands. So here again, we've got Shaul with the spear and David with his musical instrument.
Exactly. The contrast here, and both mentions the issue of the hand.
Then Shaul sought to pin David to the wall with the spear, but he slipped away from Shaul's presence, and he drove the spear into the wall. So David fled and escaped that night. Now, that's certainly...
yours says to pin. It says lehakot, which means to smite or strike down. So basically to kill him.
Right.
And also, you know, he puts in the wall. You know, so the question is, what kind of walls they were using back then? Because,
oh, that's a good question.
Around this area, stone was considered to be the thing that they made houses from. And specifically, he's the king, so it's quite reasonable to say that he built everything from stone as well, probably big stones. So how come he put it through the wall? It could be that the wall had some kind of wooden paneling, or maybe the interior walls were made from some other material, brick. The way, for example, when they had burnt brick, what they used in Babylon, was actually considered to be unusual for this area. You don't really find a lot of brick houses, at least as far as I know. Again, I'm not an archaeologist, and never assumed to be an archaeologist. Don't find the subject itself sometimes very boring. If you ever read I actually sat down and read a professional archaeological book, and I fell asleep in the middle. It was that boring. And you should know, by the way, a lot of people know, people like reading stuff about archaeology, but if you really read an archaeological survey, if you read a real one, it's a snore. It's a snore and a half. It's boring. But in any case, actually successfully read through the whole thing. Understood most of what was being said there. But it could be, again, I don't think brick was common, but if it was a brick wall or a wooden wall, then putting the spear through it would have actually been possible.
Certainly, and obviously quite a deal of force. Possible as well that if it was a stone wall, that it may have been between the stones perhaps, but whatever it was, he was not fooling around. He really wanted to pin David to it. And do him in. Obviously, David saw the attempt and got out of the way and thought best not to hang around. So he fled and escaped that night. And so Shaul sent messages to David's house to watch him and to kill him in the morning. And Michal, David's wife, told him, saying, you know, if you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you will be killed. So Michal let David down through a window. And he went and fled and escaped. Now, Yoel, here's the verse that everybody wants to know. This is verse 13. And Michal took an image and laid it in the bed and put a cover of goat's hair for his head and covering with covered it with clothes. And so when Shaul he sent messages to take David, she said, "Oh, he's sick. He's in bed. He can't come." What is in the bed?
Yeah. What is in the bed? Okay. So first of all, the word in Hebrew is teraphim. And the teraphim were household images that came in varying sizes. In this case, this was a full human size type of teraphim, which is by the way, as far as I know, never been discovered something that big. They vary in from like very, very small pocket size to like something you put on your table or a little shrine in the house. Something the size of a human, I don't think was ever discovered. Those statues of people were discovered, but there's a difference. The teraphim itself was a human image type of thing. We also bump into this word teraphim with Rachel, where she sneaks them out, which means they were small enough to hide underneath the camel's pillow. Mm-hmm. But also the word teraphim is associated with fortune telling. You know, veloye ephod teraphim. It mentions the ephod together with teraphim, and the ephod was a future telling. What was it called in English? An oracle. It was an oracle. Method and everything. And there's even some descriptions where they mention that they would take the bones of a person, maybe an ancestor. Some people say it might have been an ancestor. It was a symbolized ancestor worshiping, the spirits of the patron spirit of the family, or the patrons of the patron god of the family. You know, people would create their own little gods, and it was formed in the image of a human being. And was used for oracles and telling the future and you know, stuff like that. So there's this big question. I actually also posted this on Facebook, and I got several responses. And there was one person, and I'm very thankful that they did this, where they insisted that no, this was a real idol, and this was a sin, and this would explain why King Solomon also sinned with idols and stuff like that. And I'm very appreciative of this idea, and I can understand where you come from that. But the thing with King Solomon specifically, if you look at it, first of all, Michal wasn't Solomon's mother. It was Bathsheba who was Solomon's mother. But that's one, first of all, very important thing. King David was a king. He didn't have time to run around with his kids all day. So the education, and by the way, in the ancient world, the education of a child up to a certain age was the mother's hands. Mm-hmm. So you can't say like father, like son, okay?
Sure.
Because it won't work. And Michal wasn't Bathsheba. That's number one. Number two, King Solomon it states clearly in the Book of Kings that King Solomon was corrupted by his wives, not by his mother or anything like that.
Sure.
But we do have to entertain the possibility that there was a certain level of confusion regarding what is the worship of God of Israel, and things were mixed in, and there was a possibility that this was a real teraphim, this was an actual idol. You know, she might have been King Saul's daughter, but you have to remember that the worship of the Baal did exist and became completely loony during the times of Elijah. Mm-hmm. And the Baal was considered to be, it's a point where the prophets say, no, and I remove the name. Hoshea says, you will no longer call me Baali, you will call me Ishi, which is just another word for husband. Mm-hmm. You will no call, by the way, even to this very day, the word for husband in Hebrew is Baal, which means owner as well. And Saul himself had two sons, or had a son and then a grandson, they had the name Baal mixed into the names. He had Ishbosheth ben Shaul, Ishbosheth. Boshet was a name that was used. By the way, Boshet means the frontal private parts of a person. Mm-hmm. And it was a name they gave the Baal as a nasty name towards the Baal. Mm-hmm. By the way, the Talmud, for example, mentions things like this as well. Basically, you're allowed to make fun, even in a very rude way, towards an idol. And he had also Mephibosheth, again another person, and you actually have the real names Ishbal and Mephibosheth. No, they don't mention. I don't think they mention Mephibosheth's real full name, but Ishbosheth appears as Ishbal in the Book of Chronicles. So yes, there was a problem, and people did name. And you also have King David mentioning, you know, instead of calling When he had the battle against the Philistines in Emek Rephaim, instead of calling it, the Lord Paritzim or Yud Hei Vav Hei Paritzim, he calls it Baal Paritzim. So there was a certain level of mixture of holiness together with the profane. But it doesn't really 100% fit the character of David. David might have sinned, but he was very, very loyal to the God of Israel.
Mm. So the question that's in my mind then, Yoel, is this something that came with Michael? Is this something that's commonplace in Shaul's household?
It's possible, but again, the distance between using the name Baal as recognizing it as being a proper name to the God of Israel and actually having an idol, which is clearly a very, very specific worship, I think there's a difference between it. For example, if I had a statue or something that symbolized the God of Israel, like, for example, the ephod that Gideon creates, and it was supposed to be worship of the God of Israel, and it became something else, that's one thing. But having a very, very specific, very, very specific type of worship, if you have an Asherah pole or something like that, immediately people recognize that as being something which is outside of the worship of the God of Israel. Mm. God says, don't make a statue to represent me or to worship me. Mm-hmm. But for example, if I take a Buddha and put it up and say, oh, this represents the God of Israel, people would laugh their heads off because everyone knows what a Buddha is.
Of course.
Okay? So this is why I have questions here about this one. I'm not too sure. David was very, very loyal, and there's no mentioning that he was disloyal to the God of Israel, except for places where he actually committed real sins, mm-hmm. where these were criminal sins. These were not sins against
And it doesn't attempt to hide those at all.
The Bible doesn't cut slack to anyone. If you sinned, you get snapped, hit over the head for it.
Yeah.
But in any case, it's possible. And I actually looked at this, and I found one source that mentions this possibility that this was not an idol, that the name Teraphim was also used for mentioning anything that looked like a human being. And there was one source that claimed that this might have been a mannequin and not really an idol.
Mm-hmm.
And that would explain why she had this. And that it was that there was some practice of having a mannequin in the house. Remember, if it's an idol, she puts it inside his bed. There's something kind of weird.
Let me ask you this, and I don't know about this. Maybe you know about this, but let's be hypothetical. Is it possible that they had some sort of a structure on which to put David's armor, for example, or certain robes?
Exactly.
Something like that.
This thing was shaped as a human being to put his armor up. He didn't take his armor and just dump it somewhere.
Mm.
You look at this in different cultures, armor was hung up on a mannequin.
Mm.
Okay, so it's quite possible that this was a mannequin that looked like a human being because there's a headpiece for the helmet and there's a body piece for the piece of the armor. And if he has sleeve type of thing, then there's sleeve pieces and there might be leg armor. So there was a place to put the leg armor because you really had to keep your weapons organized. You had to keep them in a pristine condition.
And particularly the position that David's in, you would think he would have something like that and perhaps even an elaborate one.
Exactly. And the more important you were, your weapons were better, your clothing was better, and this might be it. So the name Teraphim here is more borrowed than anything else.
Okay. So I'm liking that, and taking that into consideration, Yoel, if that is correct, I'm liking the New King James's word for Teraphim. They use the word image. It's an image. They don't say idol. Now the notes here that I've got in my study Bible, it says the Hebrew word for image is used elsewhere in Scripture to indicate household idols. Some have suggested that here the word means a life-sized object of a man. Now, they don't go into detail as to what it might have been used for, but I really do think that is a fair conclusion to come to, particularly considering David's position and the armor that he would have had. One thing that I do find interesting, and I don't know if there's anything here, maybe you can speculate on this, but this is the second time that we see goat's hair used in the Tanakh to deceive somebody. That I think the time before this was Jacob used it on his arm to impersonate Esau before Isaac.
Yeah, so there's several things here. First of all, it shows several things. First of all, it means that they could put goat's hair, mm-hmm. and it looks like human hair to a certain degree. It's a bit thicker, but it looks like human hair mm-hmm. from a distance.
Sure.
And you also what's very interesting is they lift the bed and they take the bed with them. So it wasn't clear that this was not human hair. Now, what the word kvir actually means, there's some people say that it's related to some other word. Let's open up the source that deals with this just a second.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like a blanket type of thing or a pillow type of thing. Some related to that was translated by the by some translation as a gaunka or gaunaka, which is an ancient Persian word for a blanket or something. This was probably it can be one of two things. It can be either the hide itself.
Mm-hmm.
with the hair on it,
mm-hmm.
basically kind of a carpet type of thing or a wool mm-hmm. hanging, mm-hmm. or that this was something which was made from goat's hair and it was some kind of blanket. And she folded in some way or is positioned in some way that it looked like as if it was his hair.
Right.
Now, there's a few things you learn from this. First of all, you learn from this that he might have had slightly long hair as well.
Mm-hmm.
And way back then, people had long hair. The question is, did he have braided hair or not? And the thing is that probably women braided their hair. Men didn't braid their hair as much as women would. Hair braiding was more of a feminine thing to do, mm-hmm. maybe at least at that period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But we do find some places where the kings or important people would maybe curl their hair, not necessarily braid it,
mm-hmm.
and to some degree even braid their, curl their beards as well. So they had nice looking thick beards. Maybe even add some hair to it and make the beard look thicker. And it's also another thing that you learn from this is that I've never seen a goat that was a redhead.
Oh, I have actually, and they originate
not in this area.
There is the boar, which the boar goat, which originates from Africa, and it's a very good meat goat. And usually they are white with tan heads, but every now and then you'll get a red one, and it's a deep red. But I wouldn't compare it to that sort of orangey ginger typical redhead that we see in people.
Yeah, but even if we say it's like, for example, a very dark orange. My grandmother, for example, being she came from Eastern Europe, and she was one of those rare occasions today. I mean, it used to be back then; it wasn't that rare. One of those rare occasions, we actually had a dark-skinned European Jew,
mm-hmm.
and she also had this very dark, burnt orange type of hair color, which, by the way, sprouts every once in a while in my family. Where every last one of us and my brothers, we all have dark hair, but every last one of us also has a section where if you grow it long, there's this orangey piece that comes out.
Really,
you can see if you look at the right light, you see light, this orangey piece that comes out, and we sometimes have orange hairs in our beard, which is has to do with my grandmother. But that might have been a type that was basically a rusty type of orange.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case. The types of goats that you find here in Israel, the lightest color you would find is either white
mm-hmm.
or brownish color. So I did some study, and they assumed that most of the goats in this area, and specifically in the mountain area, were probably mostly black.
Right. Okay. So we assume that it's black hair, and we go back to the conversation that we had when David was introduced only a couple of chapters before. Referring to him as ruddy, and we were talking about how that probably applies to his complexion, his lips, his cheeks. He was had a reddish complexion rather than having red hair.
Exactly.
Makes sense. Exactly. And so Shaul sent messages to take David. She said to them, look, he's sick, he's not going anywhere. And Shaul sent the messages back to see David, saying, bring him up in his bed if he's so sick. I don't care. Bring him in his bed so I can kill him. And when the messages had come in, there was the image in the bed with a cover of goat's hair for his head. And Shaul said to Michal, why have you deceived me like this and sent my enemy away so that he has escaped? This is what you were referring to earlier. And Michal, she lied and said to Shaul, well, he said to me, let me go, for why should I kill you? If you don't let me go, I'm going to have to kill you. And so I let him go.
So, by the way, I mentioned, she answered the door. Knock, 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 open the door, and she says, oh, he's sick. Now, it could be that they didn't see anything, and they took her word for it, or that, this was a one-room house, so they could see someone lying down in the bed. They could peek in the door and see the bed there, and he they could see that because, you know, you take your word for it.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, maybe she didn't know, so they took her word for it. And then he said, no, go get him. And when they entered and they lifted the blanket, then they saw.
Mm.
By the way, it mentions he being covered with a begid, which means a piece of clothing or a blanket.
Mm-hmm.
It's parallel to what it mentions in the first Book of Kings, where, you know, they covered David with blankets or with clothing and he didn't feel warm at all.
Oh, true. When he was at the end of his life, when he was quite old.
Yeah.
The last remaining verses, which bring us to the end of chapter 19, is really weird. Well, let me read these out, and then you can. Now, we have touched on this before, but you're going to have to touch on it again because this is really quite odd. It says, so David fled and he escaped, and he went to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Shaul had done to him, and he and Samuel went and stayed in
Nayot.
Nayot. Now, it was told Shaul, saying, take note, David is at Nayot in Ramah.
Nayot, yeah.
Nayot in Ramah. And Shaul sent messages to take David, and they saw a group of prophets prophesying, and Samuel, standing as leader over them, and the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Shaul, and they also prophesied. And when Shaul was told, he sent other messengers, and the messengers, they also went, they prophesied likewise, and then Shaul sent messages again, and the third time, they prophesied also. Then he went to Ramah and came to the great well that is in, where's this, Sechu. So he asked, you know, where are Samuel and David? And someone said, oh, indeed, they're over at Nayot and in Ramah. And so he went over to Nayot in Ramah. Then the Spirit of God was upon him also, and he went on and prophesied until they came to Nayot in Ramah. And he also stripped off his clothes and prophesied before Samuel in like manner and lay down naked all that day, all that night. Therefore, they say, is Shaul also among the prophets? What's going on there?
So first of all, this kind of slightly reminds me of the whole story with Elijah, where he's sitting at Mount Carmel and he's sitting on that rock.
Mm-hmm.
And Ahab or Ahab sends messengers three times and they get burnt. So not exactly the same thing here, but what basically happens is that he runs off to a place called Ramah, which is where Samuel actually lived. And by the way, this is the first time we hear Samuel for a couple of chapters. Suddenly Samuel shows up again because he becomes an important character. An important character, but we start seeing a relationship between David and Samuel because David knows that he was anointed to be king.
Yes.
And Samuel is the messenger of God. So he says, okay, something's wrong here. Something's fishy. I probably have to get my priorities in order. I have a position here. Saul apparently has figured this out. He's probably, something's been leaked to him because I don't think that Saul doesn't know yet that David was anointed, but he's realizing something's going on. He says, okay, I have to find my alliances. I have to find people to be involved with. So he runs off to Samuel. Samuel being one of the big, is the big leader of Israel besides Saul.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, okay, I have to create my alliance here with him. So he runs off to this place called Ramah, which is the place where Samuel lives, but then they move to a place called Nayot. Now, Nayot Barama is not necessarily a name of a place. The word Nayot is the plural of the word Nave. And a Nave is usually Neve HaRoim, which is the shepherding or the places where the flocks would live.
Okay.
So this is outside of the city called Ramah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And it seems that these prophet type of people were not living in cities. They would live in the encampments around the city, maybe because being in nature was something that helped them with the ability to become prophets. I mean, these are not proper prophets. These are what we can call ecstatic prophets. Mm-hmm. These are people that get ecstatic revelation, or they get, you know, more modern way, hooked up into the main source of energy and have a spiritual experience.
Mm-hmm.
Because prophecy, you know, again, you have to remember something. Prophecy is not necessarily just an issue of receiving the word of God and knowing the future or knowing the message of God. Sometimes the issue is to know that you have a spiritual experience where you feel the presence of God. That's sometimes something that some of us just want to achieve. You know,
sure.
In the East, they're very big on that. You know, reaching a oneness with the universe or something,
enlightenment, and
enlightenment or something. So you know, when you have a spiritual experience, it kind of changes you and has a certain effect on you.
Mm-hmm.
So they run off over there. They both sit there, and they're probably somewhat protected because it's a very spiritual place.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're in a spiritual place, first of all, maybe your morality as a person goes up. So maybe if soul sends messengers or he himself comes in, maybe the effect of being in such a spiritual place would cause him to maybe have a better experience, maybe get rid of this evil spirit that's hanging around his head, or maybe even get exposed to the word of God, causing him to change his mind about certain things. So they run off, and they go there, and he's sending his messengers, and the messengers, every time they walk in, prophecy, all of a sudden they're having this great time in cloud nine or something.
Do we interpret that as they have all of a sudden they are overwhelmed by the presence of God?
Again, is it the presence of God, or is it
the
just
atmosphere? What do you think?
No, they're walking in. They're walking into a very, very spiritual place, and this it's like a fountain. It's spraying everywhere, and it hits everyone.
Okay.
So this is why you can have group prophecy. It's no longer one person standing there with prophecy. This is like tapping into something. This is at least what it looks like.
Is this? Is this the same as what we see in? Is it Deuteronomy? Where there is in the camp around the tabernacle, the elders all start to prophesy. It's the same kind of thing. It's contagious.
It's not in Deuteronomy. It's in Numbers.
It's in Numbers.
It's contagious. It's like it's an outpour of spirituality. Now, not everyone receives it. But here specifically, they're walking into a very, very strong center. So no matter what you do, something happens to everyone. Mm-hmm. So this is like a fountain spraying all over the place, and everyone gets hit to some degree or another. So each person received a different level of revelation. I would say, but each person is affected by the fact that they're next to this powerful source. The fact that Samuel is there. Samuel, as we mentioned, was the beginning of prophecy. So he opened up the tap. And the tap is now pouring. And now anyone that goes into these places where they establish these groups, and these are groups of prophets, they walk in and suddenly everyone's suddenly prophesizing. Mm-hmm. And here specifically, maybe there's also a certain level of, receiving prophecy. It also disables the person from being rational. The person is like, he walks in, he can't function anymore. And that might be part of what God is doing. God's like indirectly intervening into the situation when they send messengers and they can't really do anything. Instead of, killing them or discombobulating them or something. So the thing is that he sends a third group, and again, a third time is a charm. And he suddenly realizes, okay, this is not a chance. This is actually happening. Something's going on. So he said, I'll get up. I'll do it. Maybe he was thinking, I have this bad spirit around my head. Maybe the good spirit versus the bad spirit will balance out, and I'll be perfectly sensible. Maybe that's one of the thoughts. It's a counterbalance. I'm throwing ideas here. I can't really say
that. Not only was he also totally overwhelmed and distracted, but he goes on to strip naked and lie down for a whole day.
Yeah. Well, also it mentions here, they go to this pit, the great pit, which is at the Secho. What is this Secho thing? It's very, very interesting. But it's the Secho. It's not at Secho. It's the Secho. But because the bet, the preposition bet here has the vowel points and the signs of a definite article. So what is it? Basecho? And I'm actually going to try to find an answer there. It suddenly dawned on me that that's what it shows up as.
So you're saying, because I've got here, and he came to a great well. You're saying that it's a pit.
It's a bowl. It's not a be'er. A be'er is a well. A bowl is a pit. This is one of those large pits that they dug that were coated with lime inside and plaster to collect water. So this is a water pit.
Ah, I see what you're saying. Okay.
Let me just look at what this basecho, because secho should be a place. So why is it? Why is it indefinite article?
I've got here in my notes, it is not mentioned elsewhere in the Bible. It was probably north of Jerusalem in the region of Gibeah at Ramah.
First of all, it's possible that this place, that the Asecho, it does mention that there are, for example, that it's a name of a place. So rule is that when you have a name of a place, you don't put a definite article before it, because it's a name of a place, it's a specific place. And if it's, for example, a place where you have two, three names which are attributed, for example, Kadesh Gilad and Kadesh in the desert or something, or Kedesh Binyamin, there's all these different names, then it mentions, it gives an adjectival name next to it mentioning such and such place of such and such place. It's, you know, so you have a double name or a name that is repeated in several places where you have one in the north, one in the south, he mentions the one in the north and the one in the south. Mm. Here, so that's the rule. So you don't put a definite article. But I'm looking at this commentary here, and he mentioned that, for example, in Judges 8, verse 1, there's a place called Kalkol, and it's referred as Bakalkol. So it occasionally happens that you would mention a name of a place with a definite article. It's rare, but it can happen. So this is the same thing. So Sechu is actually a name of a place. And it might be also spelled sometimes with a hey. Here it's spelled with a vav. And sometimes we spell it like with a hey, like for example, Shiloh. Mm-hmm. Shiloh is sometimes spelled with a vav, sometimes spelled with a hey. So he goes there and he strips his clothing off and he says that he's naked. Now, some people want to say that doesn't mean he was naked, like, you know, birthday suit, as some people would say. But it means that it symbolizes he stripped off his garments and he's standing there with his loincloth. He wasn't really completely naked. And there's a symbolism here that, you know, he is now in the presence of God, and he's having this dispute here with someone. And now what's happening, he goes in front of God or in the presence of this prophetic reality, and he's stripping everything off. He's stripping his pride. He's stripping his royalty. Now he's just a human being in front of God. Basically, kind of a hint like, knock it off. David's a human. You're a human. Just knock it off. Stop with the pride.
It's interesting though, because of course there is the Torah saying, you know, when you go up on the altar, there are precautions that you take so that your nakedness is not exposed. But it also reminds me, Yoel, of when David dances with all his might before the ark, and his wife Shaul's daughter Michal, she rebukes him for that, and it makes me wonder, because she says, you know, you expose yourself before everyone dancing like that. It's not fitting for a king to act like that, but he was dancing before Jehovah. Is there possibly a connection here?
It's possible. That's no, on a broad type of analysis of the storyline, the answer is yes. It's like, you know, she should have known, because this happened to her father. She should have known that being, you know, exposing yourself before God is a symbol of being humble. Mm. And she should have known this from her father's experiences. She should have known better. And she actually was punished for this, by the way.
She
had no children until she died.
That's right.
So, I think as a broad connection, yes, I think that should be, that line should be drawn in between these two. So basically, there's a moral here. The moral story is, knock it off. We're all human beings. And, you know, this is why the king, for example, is not supposed to be that, you know, you're supposed to have housing and, sorry, housing, okay, houses being built here. Mm. They shouldn't have, you know, gold and horses and their wives and everything. Mm. And because, you know, he's just a human being. He's the leader, but he's just a human being. It's the whole idea of God actually being our king and being our leader. And this is why, for example, the zealots of the Second Temple period, they said, we have no king besides God. We have no master besides God. Mm-hmm. And they preferred to die than to have a master like the Romans or even anyone else. Mm-hmm. And this is the basic idea. In the Second Temple period, they still lived a bit part of what's going on in the First Temple period. And in the First Temple period, there was criticism of the idea of having a king.
Sure.
People preferred to say, our king is God. We don't need a ruler. We need an occasional ruler because we have enemies, and we might, you know, we have the leadership of the elders, but we don't need someone who's going to impose his power and authority mm-hmm. over us. That's only in the hands of God.
Yep.
And to some degree, they were right. God is the power above us. He is our king. He is our judge. And there's a verse in Isaiah that says that.
Mm.
You know, essentially, God has messengers and has people that, you know, he sends to be his leaders, but humans are fallible. Humans can make mistakes. Mm-hmm. And this is where we always say our true king is God and no one else.
Amen. Amen. So it's a little bit unusual, but there it is, the end of chapter 19. Would love to hear from the listeners. If you have any comments to add to that, Love to hear about that. But next week, we are going to be in chapter 20. And again, we see Jonathan and David and the bond that they have between each other. My goodness, chapter 20 is quite a decent size. That one goes on for a bit, Yoel. You and I are going to be busy next week. But thank you, my friend. Hebrew in Israel. And once again, let me just remind the listeners, if you would like to, and let me encourage listeners to contribute back to Yoel, if you would like to donate to Yoel, the email address is hebrewinisrael@gmail.com. hebrewinisrael@gmail.com. Contact Yoel first. And again, also, if you'd like Hebrew lessons, get on the waiting list. You can use that email as well. And Hebrew in Israel on Facebook. Like the page, get involved there as well. Thank you, my friend, for coming back on to Light of the Prophets.
You're welcome, and this is always a pleasure to do this program with you. By the way, it suddenly dawned on me, I'm the longest lasting program on Truth to You.
That could be true, you know. I think that's
as far as I know, it's true. I mean, Nehemiah and Keith did something for a year.
They did the Torah
Pearls, which are very, very still very, very popular. People still listen to it. By the way, when you Google Truth to You, one of the first things that pops up is Torah Pearls, which is kind of ridiculous. I have more programs. But anyhow.